Okay, well, welcome back for part eight of our introduction to American law. My name is Richard Clem, and you can find out more about this and my other continuing legal education programs at my website, richardclem.com. Today, we're in part eight. We're going to be covering the topic of the criminal law. Specifically, we'll be talking about the substantive criminal law today. And then in lesson nine, we will talk about criminal procedure. But today we're going to be taking a look at the substantive criminal law. And in our text, we are following chapter eight of Law 101 by Feynman. And today's portion of the program covers pages 255 through 300 of the text. So what's the criminal law? How can we define that? Well, the author starts out with a definition of that criminal law is all about punishing the bad guys. We'll get into a little bit more detail about that, but that's probably a pretty good definition of what exactly criminal law is. And maybe we'll flesh that out a little bit more and maybe put it in legalese a little bit more. But ultimately, that's what criminal law is all about, punishing the bad guys. One attribute of the criminal law is that it is prosecuted by a state official. It is not something that one can take into one's own hands. So if you assault me, I can of course bring a tort lawsuit against you. I can sue you for battery and I can collect some damages. But of course, the criminal proceeding that's going on, brought by the state, would be totally independent of that. There's really not a lot of connection whatsoever. So again, it's prosecuted by a state official in Minnesota. That would be either a county attorney or a city attorney, with a few other officials who have authority to prosecute criminal cases. So, for example, if you commit a misdemeanor at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, that would be prosecuted by the Metropolitan Airports Commission. They have prosecutorial authority, and they would contract with some private attorney who would do that. But in general, it's a county attorney or a city attorney, or as it would be called probably most other states, a district attorney is often the parlance that used. But in Minnesota, generally felonies are prosecuted by the county attorney's office, and misdemeanor cases are usually prosecuted by a city attorney's office. But it's a state official in every case. And there's often a corresponding state private civil action. So as in the example I gave, if I get punched by somebody, well, I can sue them, but also the state would bring them to justice. And of course, the state could bring them to justice even if I chose not to, for whatever reason. If I decided simply to turn the other cheek, I don't have to cooperate with the state's prosecution. Of course, if I don't cooperate and I'm the victim, oftentimes that might prove fatal to the case. But ultimately, it's not my decision whether or not you're going to face criminal charges, even though I happen to be the victim. It's the state that's going to make that decision. And in Minnesota, I don't know if they're they still do this, but oftentimes the criminal complaint will say at the end of it, after reciting all the bad things that the person allegedly did, it will conclude with the phrase, against the peace and dignity of the state of Minnesota. Interestingly, that language was originally in the Minnesota State Constitution. It said all indictments shall conclude with that language. Now, I don't think that's in the current version of the Minnesota State Constitution, but many many complaints and indictments still include that language. This person committed this act against the peace and dignity of the state of Minnesota. So if you punch me And I decide I'm not going to pursue matters against you. I'm not going to bring any kind of civil action. In fact, I'm not even going to cooperate with the state authorities. Well, they can still prosecute you because I was not the only victim. The peace and dignity of the state of Minnesota was just as much a victim, and it falls upon the state to vindicate that interest. There are a few things like criminal law that aren't quite criminal law, sometimes just by statutory definition. The juvenile justice system, for example, if a juvenile commits something that would be a crime for an adult, the state can often elect or possibly be required, depending upon the age, to prosecute the person as a juvenile. And juvenile justice proceedings are deemed not to be criminal in nature because, as we will learn later on, the interest in the criminal law system is punishing criminal behavior and vindicating the peace and dignity of the state, whereas the juvenile justice system, the stated goal of that is to rehabilitate these juvenile offenders and hopefully turn them around so that they'll be productive adults. Even though many of the procedures are similar, it is a separate system, and that's by law deemed not to be criminal. Similarly, commitment of the mentally ill might certainly result in a loss of liberty as much or even more so than the criminal law. But even though there are similarities, that is not a criminal system. People interestingly enough think of the legal system as being the criminal justice system. It was interesting. One time I was in the unlawful detainer court. I was in housing court, and the judge just to kind of speed up things and make people understand it a little bit better. The landlord would they would call the case, and the landlord would present their side of it that the guy didn't pay the bill last month, and the judge incorrectly, I think, but I think wisely, would then ask the tenant, the defendant in the unlawful detainer case, guilty or not guilty, and probably expedited proceedings quite a bit because I'm guilty, I didn't pay the rent, and the court can proceed with the eviction. Or if not guilty, I had some excuse for not paying my rent, or I did pay the rent, then the case can proceed to trial. So of course that's not a criminal thing, but just like those juvenile justice cases and the civil commitment cases, there are certainly a lot of parallels to the criminal law. So the judge in that particular case decided to adopt the parlance of the criminal system, namely guilty and not guilty. In most states, including Minnesota, minor traffic violations are not considered to be criminal offenses. Now a major driving offense like drunk driving, that probably is a criminal offense. But if I get a parking ticket, that's not a criminal offense, or if I get a speeding ticket, that's not a criminal offense. In Minnesota, they are called petty misdemeanors. And simply by a stroke of the pen, the legislature said these are not crimes. Although the Minnesota rules of criminal procedure still apply. So if I want to go fight my speeding ticket, for the most part, I'll be following the same procedures as in a major felony case. But by definition, they're not criminal. And that by definition of being not criminal, that's kind of a two-edged sword. On the one hand, if I got a speeding ticket, and if anybody asks me, have you ever committed a crime? While I can truthfully say no, because the Minnesota legislature said that is not a crime. Whereas if, if it were deemed to be a criminal offense, I would have to say, well, yes. So in fact, a lot of times you'll see on papers where somebody asks that question, have you ever been convicted of a criminal offense other than minor traffic offenses? To deal with the situation of states where they are, by definition, part of the criminal justice system. The other side of that is, well, because it's not criminal, because they're just asking me to pay money, I'm not going to really be punished for it. I didn't violate the peace and dignity of the state of Minnesota, perhaps. Although, actually, the first time I ever encountered that phrase, against the peace and dignity of the state of Minnesota, it was in relation to a speeding ticket. So I guess the peace and dignity of the state is implicated at least somewhat. But because it's just the worst possible thing that can happen to me is I will lose a few dollars. Well, that means that some of the procedural protections that we'll talk about in our final chapter, chapter 9, do not apply. So if I'm speeding. I was probably speeding, but there's a reasonable doubt about it. Well, I can probably still be convicted because, well, it's not a criminal offense. It's just kind of a specialized type of civil case, according to the legislature. Some of those things, although, they're probably very similar, but kind of by definition, they are not part of the criminal law. But again, they're violations of the peace and dignity of the state of Minnesota. In other words, it's a wrong against the public good. Yes, there's a victim. If I commit assault or if I commit robbery, there's certainly a victim. But even if we can't identify the victim, it's still potentially a criminal offense because it's an offense against the public good, against the peace and dignity of this state. Another attribute of the criminal law that we'll talk about in more detail in a little while is that most criminal offenses have some kind of a culpability requirement, or a mens rea. Remember that from law school? You learned a little bit of Latin in your criminal law case. Or, in other words, an element of intent. In general, and we'll talk about it in a little bit more detail, but as a broad generality, criminal offenses are intentional offenses. There has to be some element of intent involved. That's one thread that runs through much of the criminal law. Now, the criminal law is very much so defined by statute. So if you're listening to this CLE program in a different state, well, it's impossible to have something that's going to cover the entire criminal law everywhere, because a crime in your state is, by definition, whatever the legislature of your state decided was a crime. Now, historically, many of those crimes are going to be the same or very similar in many different states. I don't think there are any states where that do not have a law against murder or against robbery or something. The main thing to remember about criminal offenses, though, it can't be a criminal offense unless the legislature has defined it as being a criminal offense. What is the purpose of the criminal law? Well, the author points out two of them. One of them is to define wrongful behavior. But more importantly, the second prong of it is to provide punishment for wrongful behavior. Not just compensation, or in fact, not compensation at all. Kind of as an afterthought, a lot of times, our criminal laws have an element of restitution involved in them. The judge sentences the person to a certain term in prison and orders them to pay restitution. But that's oftentimes just kind of added in as an afterthought, because the main point of the criminal law is punishment. The word punishment is pretty broad because sometimes people will ask, well, what's the goal of the criminal justice system? Is it punishment or rehabilitation? Well, rehabilitation is kind of one element of punishment. So even if you're in favor of rehabilitation, you're really in favor of punishment so that somebody can be rehabilitated. But because punishment is really the only thing that the criminal justice system does. And what are what are some of the reasons why we punish people? Well, these really come, remember in law school you learned that there are three R's and a D, I think, or four R's and a D. The author kind of breaks it down into two categories. And the first one is the utilitarian goals of the criminal justice system, the utilitarian goals of punishment. And here we find some of the R's and one of the D's. And the utilitarian reasons, having criminal law simply for utilitarian reasons, so that society runs a little bit better. And those utilitarian goals of punishment are, first of all, restraint. If, this bad guy is out there committing crimes, if we lock him up, he's not going to commit any more crimes. So it's, pretty straightforward. You can't rob the 7-Eleven if you're spending time in the state prison. So restraint is one of the main goals. Hopefully you catch things before you have to restrain people. So you want to deter people. You want to stop people from committing crimes in the first place, not just lock them up so they're not physically able to do it. So deterrence is the other big reason, the utilitarian reason for the criminal justice system. And that's sometimes broken down into two categories, individual deterrence and general deterrence. So, it's kind of, I don't know exactly where you draw the line between one and the other. So I think it's safe just to call it deterrence in general, but you want a society-wide deterrence, so that everybody knows, I'm not supposed to commit crimes. I'm not supposed to rob the 7-Eleven because one of the reasons I don't rob the 7-Eleven is because I'm deterred by the criminal law. Because I know if I go in there and try to steal something, that there is at least a possibility that I'll wind up going to jail for it. So that deters me from it. Now I'm generally a pretty law-abiding person, or I'm a pretty peaceful person. So even if we didn't have any criminal law, I probably wouldn't be out committing robbery. There probably aren't too many crimes I personally am deterred from committing. I don't know. I suppose maybe if there was no law against it, I don't know if I would still pay my taxes. But for a lot of people, and for me to a certain extent, one of the reasons why I don't commit that particular crime is deterrence. Because if I commit that crime of tax evasion, well, I'm going to go to jail. So that's one of the reasons why I continue to pay my taxes, as required by law. So deterrence serves a part. The other utilitarian aspect of the criminal justice system is rehabilitation. That's one of the other R's. Rehabilitation. If you're leading a life of crime, well, we're gonna lock you up in Stillwater State Prison, Well, while you're there, you'll have a lot of time to think about it. Maybe you'll finish your high school diploma. There's a little bit of rehabilitative services that are there, but I guess it would be nice if when you come out, because we probably can't keep you locked up forever. I guess it would be nice if you came out rehabilitated. You made the decision to become a productive member of society. I don't know how successful that is. I don't know how good our prison system is at rehabilitating people. But that would be a nice goal if we could do that. So if we, maybe the best we can hope for is that, While all these other things are happening, maybe you will have an epiphany and you will use that opportunity to finish your high school degree or maybe even earn a college degree while you're in prison or something. So so rehabilitation, that's one of the utilitarian goals. But the other utilitarian goals are just deterring you, stopping you from committing the crime in the first place, and restraining you. If you do commit the crime, well, at least you'll be in jail where you can't commit any more crimes, at least not against the general public. So those are the utilitarian goals of our of punishment. And the other one is retribution. And retribution just means, well, you committed an offense against the peace and dignity of the state, and we deserve our pound of flesh. A really good example of that, I think, is you have this it's Gilligan's Island or whatever. You have this these group of people stranded on some island somewhere. If one of those people murders somebody else, well, you want to punish that person because, if Gilligan murders somebody, we have to lock him up. Well, at the very least, we need to restrain him so he won't murder other people. Maybe we can rehabilitate him. Maybe we can deter it. So even in our, in that little, legal system, we probably, have a law against murder. But what if that murder happens the day before they get rescued? Well, then there's absolutely no utilitarian goal of punishing that person. But on the other hand, justice cries out that since he murdered somebody, he has to pay the price for that. So that is, I think, as good an explanation as I've seen of the goal of retribution in the criminal justice system. Getting back to those utilitarian goals, it used to be that judges had a lot of discretion, and they could figure out, how much restraint does this person need. What message will I send to the public as far as deterrence? How likely is this person to be rehabilitated? And the judge could take those things into consideration frankly, use some discretion in sentencing an individual person. The pendulum has swung far the other way on that. Now in Minnesota and the federal system, and probably a lot of other states, we have pretty strict sentencing guidelines. So the judge doesn't really have a lot of discretion. And those sentencing guidelines are often in reaction to an idea that, these judges are just being too soft on crime. I don't know if that's the case, but they can't be soft on crime anymore because they really have little alternative but to apply the sentencing guidelines, and they don't have a lot of discretion when it comes to that. Well, before the state throws somebody in jail, a person has to violate a law, and that means there has to be a criminal act. Somebody has to do something. They have to commit a criminal act, or that other Latin phrase you learned back in law school, and there has to be an actus reus. There has to be a bad act. What is an act? Well, an act is merely a movement of the body. So in order to go to jail, you have to move your body in such a way as is prohibited by a statute. Moving your body by taking a gun and pointing at somebody and shooting them, or moving your body in such a way as to hit somebody, or moving your body in such a way to mail in your fraudulent tax return or something. There has to be a movement of the body. Now, there has to be a lot more than a movement of the body, as we'll learn later on when we talk about the mens rea. There has to be a criminal intent of some kind. But at a minimum, there has to be a voluntary act on your part. So if I deposit my fraudulent tax return in the mailbox, well, that's a voluntary act on my part. If I punch you, that's a voluntary act on my part. If I have a seizure, and in the course of my seizure, I punch you, well, that's not a voluntary act. So there has to be an act. And, you know, then you get into things like, well, what about sleepwalking? Well, is that a voluntary act? And you get into a lot of issues like that. But there has to be an act. I have to do something. It has to be a voluntary act. And kind of the leading case on that point, I guess, is the case of Robinson versus California from 1962, where the Supreme Court said, no, you can't prosecute somebody under a statute that says you can't be a drug addict within the state of California. Because the state of California criminalized being a drug addict. Well, one of the reasons why that statute was struck down, and there were other reasons for it, but one of the main reasons, I think, is because there was no act. The person didn't do anything. They were just being a certain status. Now, they might have voluntarily become an addict, but that might have happened in another state. You know, so, you know, you go to, you know, Nevada and get yourself hooked on narcotics. And then you go to California and you don't actually do anything in California. But the mere status of being there, and the Supreme Court said, no, that's not enough. On the other hand, it doesn't have to be very much of an act. As we see from the Powell versus Texas case in 1968, because in that case, the state of Texas said it's a crime to be drunk in a public place, so public intoxication. And in the Powell case, the Supreme Court said, no, that's really different from Robinson, because that's more of an act. And I don't know exactly where you would draw the line, but I think we can draw the line by saying, well, you became drunk. Either you were in a public place and you got drunk, which, you know, is a so that's your act, getting yourself drunk, or you were already drunk and then you put yourself in a public place and that was your act. So in Powell, the court said that was enough of an act, whereas Robinson, the court said merely being an addict and being in a place, that is not enough. So that I don't know exactly where that line is, and I'm not sure if I can totally articulate the difference between those two cases, but there has to be some minimal kind of act. Can a failure to act be a crime? Well, probably not in general. But there are some exceptions, because sometimes the law does impose a particular duty to act, such as, for example, paying taxes and filing your tax return. You have an affirmative duty to do that. And if you don't file an income tax return, or if you don't pay your taxes, well, then there's a crime of voluntary failure to file, or voluntary failure to pay taxes. So there is an affirmative duty there. There's a duty to stop at an accident in which you were involved. So if I'm just driving along and I see some horrendous accident, you know, do I have to stop and help the people? Well, no. But there is a law in Minnesota and most other states probably that says if I was involved in the accident, even if maybe it wasn't my fault, but if I was involved in that accident, I have a duty to stop and, you know, tell the other person my name and so forth. There's a duty by statute to provide support for your children. So if you have children and you decide not to feed them, well, that's, even though there's no act on your part, that's still a criminal offense. So in general, there's no failure to act, but there are some particular duties imposed by law. So it has to be a voluntary act, but it has to be more than a voluntary act in most cases. Because in general, a criminal offense has to be intentional. I have to intend to do something. Yes, I had a voluntary action to move my fist, but I didn't know your face was there. I did not intend to hit your face. Well, that would probably not be a criminal act. It would not be an intentional assault anyway. It might be some kind of negligent crime. We'll talk about that in a minute. But in general, when a statute tells you to do something, you have to intend to do it. Oftentimes, the words used in the statute are intentionally or purposely. You have to do things on purpose. You have to intend that result to happen. Not the exact result, but I intended to punch your face. I didn't merely voluntarily move my arm. There was more to it than that. I knew that there was a face there, and I knew that it was I was going to hit it. So I have to intend it, or at the very least, I have to be reckless about it. So maybe if the statute is kind of silent on the subject, it says, no one shall punch other people in this state. If the statute is silent about it, I could probably be convicted of that offense if I was reckless about it. So I knew that there was probably a face there. It was a conscious risk. And I swung my arm anyway. I didn't know for 100% that you were there. That's defined as reckless behavior, and I would, and that's kind of that's almost intentional. So if the statute said purposely and intentionally, yeah, that might be enough. Or if it was silent on it. If it's silent on it, though, it has to be at least reckless or intentional. It probably can't be the next layer down, negligent. So if I'm driving not using reasonable care, and pretty much the same reasonable care we talked about when we talked about negligence in torts, very similar concept, although the criminal definition probably might be a little bit different. But if I am negligent about doing something, and the statute says that I could be a criminal offense to do it in a negligent way, then that might be sufficient. So, for example, if I'm driving negligently and I cause an accident and I injure somebody, well, I'm guilty of negligent. If I kill somebody, I'm guilty of negligent homicide, for example, in that situation. It wouldn't be the same level of crime as if I intentionally murdered somebody, but many statutes prescribe negligent behavior. And finally, there are a handful of statutes and the legislature has to be clear about it. And there are limitations on it, but there are some strict liability crimes. They're kind of rare, and in fact, there are a lot of times in that kind of netherworld of decriminalized behavior that's kind of quasi-criminal. What we would call in Minnesota a petty misdemeanor. They kind of look like criminal offenses. The complaint might even say peace and dignity. So if I'm in a 30 mile per hour zone, I'm driving 35 miles an hour, and I get a speeding ticket. If I go into court and say, well, Your Honor, my speedometer was broken, there was an optical illusion. I didn't realize it was going that fast. I wasn't even negligent about it. The judge would say, guilty as charged, because that's a strict liability offense. Or in some states, it might be called a crime, a petty misdemeanor crime. So that's a strict liability thing. They don't have to show that I was negligent in allowing my speed to creep over the speed limit. They don't have to prove anything like that. The mere fact that, I was going faster than the speed limit, that's all I need. That's all they need to establish to find me guilty. At this point, we're going to give our first code number for this section of the program. And that code number is 8-119. 8-119, 8-119, 8-119 is our first code number for this part of the program. Can you be guilty for, can you be criminally responsible for things that other people did? And yeah, you can. And that the author talks about that on page 209, talking about, vicarious liability. Can you be guilty criminally for the acts of another? In many cases you can. And first of all, if you use the phrase vicarious liability, then you're probably talking about some kind of guilty for things that your employee did. So you own a convenience store, and your convenience store is selling beer and cigarettes to minors. But you didn't have anything to do with it. It was that clerk that you hired. But they're committing this offense. You're probably criminally liable for that. You're going to be guilty. So there are some situations where there can be vicarious liability for criminal offenses. Now, can a corporation be a defendant? And the answer is yes. Although that's a variance from the common law. I don't know where this phrase came from, but at common law, a corporation. So, you know, could the Dutch East Indies Company be convicted of a crime? And the answer is no, because they have no soul to damn, no body to kick. So they can't be convicted of a criminal offense. But today, of course, they can. So, if your convenience store that's selling beer to kids is incorporated, well, that corporation can be guilty of a criminal offense probably be fined or something for that. So, there's vicarious liability. And later on, not to be confused with, we'll talk about, can you be an accessory to a crime or a conspirator? We'll talk about that. That's another way you can be guilty for the crimes of another. But yeah, there are forms of vicarious liability. Talking about some of the defenses. And the first defense the author talks about is mistake. If you're out shooting guns, and the reason why you're out shooting guns is because you're a hunter and you're doing some perfectly legal hunting, and you see a deer and you shoot the deer. Well, that's not a problem, but then you see somebody wearing a brown coat and you haven't had your eyes checked for a while, and you shoot at this brown fuzzy object. Lo and behold, it was not a deer. It was somebody wearing a brown coat. You made a mistake. The answer is yeah, that you can't be convicted of that intentional crime, because, you did not intentionally shoot that person. That was not a case of an intentional homicide. Now, certainly, you might have been careless in doing that. So chances are you're probably going to find yourself guilty of some kind of negligent homicide charge. But in a crime involving intent, mistake can be a defense. Another defense that's talked about in a lot more detail starts on page 270 of the text, is self-defense. Can you use self-defense? Is that a defense to a criminal charge? And it would be a defense to like assault or murder or something. And the answer is yes. Kind of a hot button issue, a lot of litigation. We're certainly not going to cover it in a lot of detail. But the test is not what you were thinking specifically, but what would a reasonable person think in that situation? Would a reasonable person, having seen what you saw, would they have thought that there was an immediate and serious threat of bodily harm to them. And if you reasonably believed that there was an imminent and serious threat, then that would serve as a defense to the charge. They talk about the Goetz case, which this person had an illegal gun and was threatened on the subway, and I don't think it was too imminent or too serious, but a jury acquitted in that case. But in general, for a reasonable person, it has to be an imminent and serious threat. It can't be somebody saying, "I'm going to come over tomorrow and shoot you." That's not an imminent threat. You know, in that situation, you should call the cops because they might not get there instantly, but they'll probably get there sometime before tomorrow. So it's not an imminent threat, and it has to be a serious threat. It has to be, you have to reasonably believe that it's going to be a case of death or serious bodily injury. But if you reasonably believe that it's an imminent and serious threat, that's a defense. The another hot button issue that is going to be different in every state, but just to be aware of the hot button issue and can't really resolve it. What if you can safely retreat? Does that make the danger less imminent? So, I'm walking down the street that I have every right in the world to be walking down this street. And you come up to me with a knife and, try to take my money. A couple of things I can do. I can use self-defense. I can shoot you, or I can run away. Do I have to run away? Because after all, I had every right in the world to be on that street. If I have, it depends on what state I'm in. If I'm in a state which says if you have the option to safely retreat, then you should safely retreat, as opposed to a state with a stand your ground law. So in a state with a stand your ground law, in that case, I don't really have to consider that option to retreat. You're gonna, unless I run away, you're gonna stab me. So what do I do? Well, I can stand my ground. I don't have to run away. I can exercise my right of self-defense, in that case. Use of force by police, obviously a hot button issue. That a lot of discussion about that. We're not going to resolve it today. Do the police have any special privileges that are not accorded to other people? In a way, I would say no. But on the other hand, they certainly don't have the an obligation to retreat if that retreat is going to mean that you're going to commit some kind of a serious crime. So police officers have in general, in addition to this right to self-defense, they have the right to use reasonable force to restrain crime. And of course, that's a whole body of jurisprudence, what exactly that right means. But it may be more so than at common law. At common law, I think they would have just been treated like any other individual. But now there are specific statutes governing them. And again, they do have that right to use reasonable force to restrain criminal behavior. That, after all, is why they are armed. Otherwise, just putting a gun on them as a show dressing wouldn't really accomplish anything. So yeah, they do have the right to use reasonable force to restrain crimes. Other defenses and justifications: the necessity defense, also known as the choice of evils defense. My driver's license got suspended, I didn't get down to renew my driver's license or whatever, but I have to rush somebody to the hospital. Am I guilty of the, That's not a criminal offense. It's a petty misdemeanor, but let's pretend it's a crime. Am I guilty of the crime of driving without a driver's license because I have to race this person to the hospital? Or I have to exceed the speed limit because I'm racing them to the hospital? Well, no, I'm not guilty of that crime because that's the necessity defense. The choice of evils. Yeah, it was evil of me to drive without a driver's license, but it would have been more evil if I would have let this person die. One interesting case we had in Minnesota, and I can't think of the title of the case. All these CLEs, I should remind everybody that if you have any questions of the presenter, you have the right under the Minnesota and most other states' CLE rules to email me questions. So you can always email or call me with questions, and I'll answer in the time required by your rules, usually the same day. I think most of the rules in most states give me a couple of days to answer your questions on these on-demand programs. So one, you might want to ask, send me an email. What was the name of that case you were talking about? In my email address, I can't email if you don't have the address. It's clem.law@usa.net. And it's all over my website, of course. Or give me a call, 612-378-7751. I'll be happy to answer any questions you have about the program. But anyway, this an interesting case from the Minnesota Supreme Court a couple of years ago was that a woman who was drunk, she was over the legal limit, and she was locked in her car, and she was about to become the victim of some kind of domestic abuse. I don't remember the exact details, but this crazy person was banging on her car, and interestingly, I think the facts in that case were such that if she had a gun with her, I think she would have fit perfectly within the necessity defense or the self-defense defense. And I think in that, given the facts of the case, from what I read about it, it looks like she would have been perfectly within her rights to pull out a gun and shoot the person dead. And I think she would have been acquitted because it was really kind of a very brutal attack she was about to get. Unfortunately, she didn't have a gun with her. What she did have was the keys to the car. So she started up the car and she drove away. But she was drunk. So she drove, as careful as could be to the nearest, business that had a telephone or whatever. And she called the cops. And I think the cops came and arrested the person, who was doing that. They said, well, wait a minute, you said you were driving and you were drunk. I guess technically I'm drunk. So I think she was charged with drunk driving. That did not make it into the any reported litigation because I think there was a plea bargain involved in that. But I think if she would have fought that, I think she would have had an excellent necessity defense. She could have said, I violated this criminal law by driving when I was, slightly over the legal limit, but the necessity defense applied. And I think she would have won that necessity defense case. But there was some kind of a plea bargain there. But the other thing that happens, of course, in Minnesota when you're driving your car over the legal limit, in addition to the criminal charges against you, there is a totally independent implied consent proceeding. Because when you are, if you're driving drunk in the state of Minnesota under this civil law that has nothing to do with the criminal law, there's a civil statute that says your driver's license will automatically be taken away. And you can go into court and ask for it back. So she went to court and asked for it back. And she said, wait a minute, the necessity defense applies here. I want my driver's license back because I was acting under the defense of necessity. Unfortunately, I think the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled wrong because the Minnesota Supreme Court said, that might have been a defense in the criminal case, but this is a totally separate civil case for the implied consent. So the Supreme Court said, no, that's not a defense in the implied consent. The statute lists all the possible defenses. You know, the police officer failed to read you your rights and whatever. There are some very specified defenses there, but necessity defense didn't say anything about it. So they affirmed the revocation of her driver's license because the necessity defense did not apply in that statutory proceeding. Although, like I say, I think if she would have pled that as a defense in the criminal case, I think she would have been a really good defense. And like I say, if she would have just pulled out a gun and shot the guy dead, that would have been okay. And she would still have her driver's license. I don't know if that case was decided right. But anyway, that kind of shows it's a good illustration, I think, of the necessity defense. The necessity defense has its limits. You probably remember this in law school. The 1884 case of the King versus Dudley and Stevens. Dudley and Stevens were out in a lifeboat starving to death. And they needed something to eat. They ate the other guy. They killed him and ate him. They committed murder. And I think it was the House of Lords in that case said, no, the necessity defense doesn't go quite that far. If they hadn't done that, all three of them would have been dead. So anyway, that's the necessity defense. The insanity defense. Again, kind of a hot button issue, unfairly a hot button issue because it really doesn't come up that much. But the insanity defense, traditionally, the easy case, if you think you're squeezing a lemon, but you're also actually wringing the neck of somebody, that's kind of the traditional definition of the insanity defense. You don't understand the physical nature of your act. Then the insanity defense would apply. The leading case for many years was the McNaughton case from 1843, an English case. The actual language is quoted on page 281 of your text. But the McNaughton case said that the insanity defense applies if you have a defect of reason that comes from a disease of the mind, such that you don't know the nature and quality of your act or if it was wrong. So in other words, you think you're squeezing lemons, but you're actually wringing somebody's neck. Not just that, but you have to think that because of a defect of reason. Well, I guess that is a defect of reason, but it has to come from a defect of the mind. Then you are not guilty because of the insanity defense. Some courts added on to that and said there was a defense if you were acting as a result of an irresistible impulse. You didn't want to kill the person. You didn't, you hoped the person would be okay, but you had an irresistible impulse. You just could not resist. It was physically impossible. Because of your mental disease, you had an irresistible impulse. Some courts had allowed that. I always like the language one Canadian case used in rejecting that. And that in that case, the judge says, if an impulse is irresistible by any other means, perhaps hanging a rope before your eyes might make it resistible. So the irresistible impulse test has kind of been pretty widely rejected. And of course, there's a lot of debate over the insanity defense, even though it really comes up pretty rarely. A couple of other related things. We have the insanity defense, not to be confused with, are you competent to stand trial? To go to trial, if you're insane by the time you get to trial, such that you just don't understand what's going on, well, then they can't have a trial while that's happening. They have to wait till you're better to have the trial. And similarly, and also you have to be competent enough to be executed. Because if we have the death penalty and we're going to execute you, well, you can't execute somebody if they don't know why they're being executed. So if you're mentally ill and you no longer understand why you're being executed, well, we have to treat you so that you recover, so that you're competent again. And then when you're competent, once we've cured you, then we can execute you. But those are to be distinguished. Those don't really have anything to do with whether or not you're guilty in the first place, the insanity defense. But there's the related concept of competency to stand trial and competency to be executed. And our second code number for this part of the program is 8-217. 8-217. 8-217 is our next code number. Some other defenses that come up. What about intoxication? Well, yeah, I committed the crime, but I didn't understand what I was doing. I was drunk. Well, that intoxication or might negate intent. But you were still probably being reckless because, you know, you shouldn't have gotten yourself drunk in that situation. So it might not help you a lot, but it might go to your intent. It might negate your intent, especially if it's not voluntary, because a lot of times the courts will make a distinction between voluntary intoxication and involuntary intoxication. Another defense that's talked about a little bit in the text is duress. If I committed the crime, but I did it to avoid imminent death or serious bodily injury. So yeah, I stole the money, but the only reason I stole the money is because this other person was telling me that they would shoot me if I didn't steal the money. That's probably a defense, the defense of duress. Now, of course, these defenses, this is going to vary from state to state because this is all statutory, as are the definitions of criminal offenses. So we're talking in very general terms, especially in this section of the program. So those are some of the defenses to a criminal offense. We already talked about vicarious liability. Can you be liable for the crimes of another? Another way that you can be liable for the crimes of another, or possibly even a crime that hasn't really happened yet, are when we talk about some of the inchoate crimes, and specifically attempt, solicitation, or conspiracy. I didn't rob the bank, but I sure tried to rob the bank. I walked in and said, "Hand over all the money," and while I was doing that, somebody walked up behind me and bonked me over the head, and I didn't succeed in my bank robbery. I didn't commit bank robbery, but I certainly attempted bank robbery. And where exactly do you draw the line? What if I'm just thinking about robbing the bank? What if I buy the gun and walk down to the bank and then I get into a traffic accident on the way to the bank. I'm not able to get there that day. For it to be an attempt, there has to be a substantial step. So yeah, walking in the door with a gun and pointing it at the teller, even though, you know, I instantly get bonked over the head, that was probably a substantial step. Driving down to the bank and getting into a car accident on the way there so I can't commit the robbery, well, that probably was not a substantial step, and I'm probably not guilty of attempt in that case. There are, on the other hand, some situations where we want to deal with those attempts. We want to nip things in the bud. So in many cases, there are statutes against things that might traditionally be looked at as attempts. So, for example, the author gives is the stalking statutes. If there's a law in Minnesota and most other states saying I can't stalk another person, you know, kind of creep up on them and watch them and everything. Even though I don't actually follow through with an assault or anything, but that's a distinct offense. They don't have to prove that I was going to assault the person. I've committed the crime just by stalking them. So that, in some cases, the problems with an attempt approach are limited by creating a new crime like that. But in general, most states, if you attempt to commit a crime, that is a crime. As long as you commit a substantial step. What about conspiracy? I conspire with you. I sit down and talk to you and say, let's go commit a crime. Let's commit a bank robbery. So it's not just an attempt, or maybe we haven't even really gotten to the attempt stage yet, but you and I are talking about it and planning the crime. We are conspiring. And that is a crime in and of itself. And because group criminality is a lot more dangerous than individuals committing crimes. You know, we can deal with the occasional person who walks into the 7-Eleven and tries to hold it up, but you know, if you have a group of people trying to figure out, hey, let's take over all the 7-Elevens in the state, group criminality is worse. So we have separate laws against conspiracy. Similarly, accomplice. If you commit a crime, you know, if you robbed the bank, but I was driving the getaway car, well, I'm just as guilty as you are because I'm an accomplice to the crime. Even though I didn't, you know, I didn't ask the teller to hand over the money, but the fact that I was out driving the getaway car, I'm guilty of that inchoate crime of being an accomplice, kind of like vicarious liability. There are a lot of specific crimes, you know, Chapter 609 of the Minnesota statutes, plus, you know, other crimes scattered in other chapters of the statutes. There are a lot of crimes in this state. There are a lot of crimes in every state. So obviously we can't talk about them, every one, but you remember in law school, you know, every state has the law against murder. So that's the one that they talk a lot about. So the author on page 291 talks a little bit about that. Traditionally there have been, you know, if you kill somebody, that's probably a crime, but there are different gradations of it. For murder, there has to be malice aforethought. There has to be an intent. You have to intend to kill the person, or it has to be substantially certain that they're going to be killed. And then different states have different degrees of murder. And this, again, is just a statutory thing. So if somebody asks, you know, well, what is the difference between first-degree murder and second-degree murder? Well, you have to look at your state statutes because, in fact, some states might not even use that terminology. But traditionally, states with first-degree murder require malice aforethought, whatever that means. So it can't just be, there has to be a little bit of advanced planning is kind of what it boils down to. Not a lot of advanced planning, but if there's no advanced planning whatsoever, then it's not first-degree murder because it's not malice aforethought. But what does that mean? I don't know what it means. So therefore, a lot of states, instead of using that terminology of malice aforethought, they'll have a list of aggravating or mitigating factors. You know, it's first-degree murder if there are some of these aggravating factors on the list. It's not first-degree murder, you know, it's a lower class of murder if there's one of these mitigating factors on the list. So it's just a recognition that some, yeah, murder is bad, but some murders are worse than others. One notch down traditional from that is voluntary manslaughter. Voluntary manslaughter is an intentional killing of somebody, but not in cold blood, in hot blood. If I kill somebody in hot blood, because I witnessed something shocking that was not actually a crime, but and I kill them for that reason, just because my blood suddenly started boiling. I had no idea that I was going to kill them. Well, that's not murder, but it's voluntary manslaughter. Also, obviously, a very serious crime. Involuntary manslaughter in most states is the name given to killing somebody negligently. So if I'm out driving drunk and I crash my car and I kill somebody, well, that's probably involuntary manslaughter. Might be probably called negligent homicide in a lot of states. Like I say, you know, Chapter 609 of the Minnesota statutes is full of criminal offenses. That's just one of them that the author talks a little bit about. You talked about in law school a lot because it's obviously a pretty serious crime. At this point, we're going to give you another code number, and that code number is 8-390. 8-390. 8-390 is the next code number before we conclude here. And we're just going to say a few words about the offense of rape. So we talked about homicide. The author talks a little bit about rape. They don't talk about burglary. They don't talk about anything else. They talk about rape. And the reason why he talks about it is kind of an important issue is one of the elements of rape is lack of consent. Does there have to be forcible compulsion in addition to lack of consent? They cite two cases. I think one was from Pennsylvania, one was from New Jersey. In one case, the person was found not guilty. In the other case, the person was found guilty, because it was a case of the victim saying no, but not fighting back. So they said, no, I'm not consenting to this, but they didn't, there was no evidence that they fought back or tried to run away or whatever. Is saying no, but not fighting back, does that constitute rape? And one case held that yes, that constitutes rape. The other case said no, that does not constitute rape because there was no forcible compulsion. There was the word no was uttered, but there was no, that was not accompanied by an attempt to fight back. I think, you know, the pendulum probably swings there, but I think the more likely approach today is no, there doesn't have to be evidence of forcible compulsion. Mere lack of consent would be enough. So anyway, that brings us to the end of Chapter 8, where we talked about the substantive criminal law. And again, what we told you today is kind of general principles that are going to vary a lot from state to state, because each legislature is going to adopt its own criminal code, and it's not a crime unless it's in one of those statutes. No matter what we say or no matter what the common law has to say. The more important part, though, is what we're going to hear in our final lesson tomorrow, where we're going to talk about criminal procedure. Because here today we talked about all the things that the state can throw you in jail for, deprive you of your liberty. We remember from one of our first lessons was that the state can't deprive you of your liberty without due process of law. So obviously, when they're doing something as important as depriving you of your liberty or maybe even your life or your property in the case of a fine, you need to be accorded some due process of law. And that's what we're going to talk about in our final chapter when we get to criminal procedure, as opposed to the substantive criminal law that we talked about today. So I look forward to seeing you then. Once again, for more information about this or my other continuing legal education programs, please visit my website at richardclem.com and have a great day.